Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're looking into the Ayn Dara Temple Complex, specifically what was understood about it before 2010. It's a really remarkable site in the Afrin region, northwest Syria.
Right, and this isn't just a standard history lesson. We know you've been curious, so we've pulled together the reports and studies from that period up to 2010. Think of it as building a picture of this amazing Iron Age temple based only on what they knew back then.
Exactly. What details were emerging? Why were archaeologists, so focused on it?
It's about getting into why it mattered, the unique finds, and how it fit into the ancient world picture at that time.
So our goal today is to pull out the key info from before 2010. How was it found? What was special about its design, its art, and that whole debate about which god it was for?
Yeah, that debate was definitely active then, and also why it kept getting compared to Solomon's temple. We've got a good stack of archaeological reports, surveys, scholarly papers, all pre-2010 to guide us.
Okay, so where does the story start?
Well, it really kicks off with a bit of luck, actually. Mid-1950s, someone finds this huge basalt lion statue.
Wow, just like that.
Pretty much. And, a find like that immediately signals, okay, there's something significant buried here. So that prompted the first formal archaeological work.
And who led those initial digs?
First, there was Faisal Sarafi. Later, and this was much more extensive, Dr. Ali Abu Asaf. He was with the Syrian Directorate General of Antiquities and Museums, the DJAM. His work really brought the Iron Age temple itself to light.
Were there other teams involved?
Yeah, later on, an American team did some surveys, focusing more on the lower town area around the main mound, the Tell.
And I remember reading about some international collaboration, too.
Absolutely crucial. In the 1990s, the Syrian DJAM worked with the Tokyo National Research Institute for Cultural Properties. That was focused on conservation and restoration of the temple. It really shows how recognized its value was, even back then.
Makes sense. And the smaller artifacts, where did they end up?
Those were generally moved to the Aleppo Museum for safekeeping. Standard practice.
Okay, let's pin down the timeline a bit. Was Ayn Dara only an Iron Age site?
No, not exclusively. The Tell itself, the main mound, shows settlement from the late 2nd millennium BCE, so late Bronze Age, right through the Iron Age. That phase seems to end around the 1st century BCE. Then there's a gap, and later occupation from the 7th century CE into the Islamic periods.
But the temple we're focused on, that's Iron Age.
Primarily, yes. Its active period is generally put between, say, 1300 BCE and 740 BCE. There's always a bit of wiggle room in dating among scholars, but that's the main window.
And what was happening politically around that?
This is the era of the Syro-Hittite kingdoms after the big Hittite empire collapsed. So it's sitting in that cultural landscape.
And the end date, 740 BCE. Did that connect to anything?
It lines up pretty well with the expansion of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. That's often seen as the likely reason for its destruction or abandonment around that time.
Did they know its ancient name?
Unfortunately, no. Not from the pre-2010 sources. But it was clearly important, probably the center of a small local kingdom.
You mentioned Dr. Asaf earlier. He had ideas about how the temple was built, right? In stages.
Yes. He proposed three main construction phases. Phase one, the initial build, maybe around 1300 to 1000 BCE. Phase two, maybe 1000 to 900 BCE, involved adding basalt piers and more reliefs.
Yeah.
Some significant modifications. And phase three, the final big addition, was that elaborate ambulatory, the gallery around the sides. That's dated roughly 900 to 740 BCE.
Interesting. And after it was destroyed.
There's evidence suggesting it was deliberately cleared out. Like rubble was removed.
Which implies?
Well, Asaf and others suggested it might mean they intended to rebuild, but for whatever reason, that plan never happened.
Were other scholars generally on board with Asaf's three phases?
By and large, yes. His model was, pretty widely accepted before 2010. Some might emphasize more continuity, less distinct breaks, maybe a more gradual evolution.
Uh-huh.
But the basic sequence, initial temple, modifications, adding the ambulatory, that was the general consensus.
Okay, let's picture the site itself. Tell Ayn Dara. It's a tell, so a mound.
Right. A high acropolis, maybe 20, 30 meters high. Pretty substantial area. And then a larger lower town spreading up below.
Fortified.
Signs of fortifications for both, yes. That basalt lion found south of the temple. One idea was it might have flanked a gateway within the acropolis defenses.
And the temple's location on the Acropolis?
It sat right on the northern or maybe northwestern edge, gave it commanding views, which seems intentional, and it consistently faced southeast.
Consistently? How sure were they about that orientation?
Pretty sure. The alignment of the main entrance, the courtyard, the inner rooms, it all pointed southeast across the different phases identified in the excavations.
Any idea why southeast?
Well, southeast is often significant in ancient Near Eastern religions, maybe related to the sunrise, certain deities. For Ain Dara specifically, it was still under interpretation back then.
Got it. And the temple itself, big.
Oh, yeah. Monumental. Dimensions vary a bit source to source, you know how it is, but roughly 30 to 38 meters long, maybe 20 to 32 meters wide. A major structure.
Let's walk through the approach. What would you see first?
You'd approach a large courtyard. It was paved with flagstones, alternating dark basalt and lighter limestone. Quite striking. In the courtyard, there was a stone basin, probably for ritual washing, purification, maybe a well, too.
And the temple wasn't level with the courtyard?
No, it stood on a platform raised about 3/4 of a meter high. The platform face was lined with basalt blocks, many carved with reliefs.
So a clear progression. Courtyard, then up onto the sacred platform.
Exactly. Symbolizing moving into a holier space. That deliberate design, it wasn't just practical. It was about creating that sense of transition.
How did you get up onto the platform?
Via this really wide monumental staircase, about 11 meters wide, made of massive basalt blocks, originally 4 or 5 steps.
Any decoration?
Oh, yes. Guardian figures flanked it, basalt sphinxes and lions, and the steps themselves had this carved pattern, a guilloche, like an interweaving band.
Okay, so you climb the steps. What's the entrance like?
You enter a portico. It's sort of a recessed porch with 2 columns, probably wooden collars originally, standing on basalt bases. Archaeologists call this style distyle in Antai's 2 columns between the projecting side walls.
Any other features at the entrance?
Yeah, these wide square projections on either side of the portico, maybe bases for towers or staircases leading up, not entirely clear. The portico floor was limestone, and crucially, this is where the first threshold with those carved footprints was found.
We'll definitely come back to the footprints. What's beyond the portico?
You enter the antecella. It's a wide rectangular room running across the building, about 6 meters deep, maybe 15 and a half wide, limestone pavement again.
Walls decorated.
Yes, with reliefs. Lions, more guilloche patterns, and these interesting panels that looked sort of like windows. Some scholars thought maybe steps led up from here into the main hall.
The main hall being the cella.
Exactly. The heart of the temple. It was nearly square, roughly 16 or 17 meters on each side, also paved with limestone. And the threshold leading into the cella that had the final footprint carving, a single right foot.
Inside the cella.
The lower parts of the walls were lined with basalt reliefs again. And at the very back, there was a raised area.
A podium.
Yeah, an elevated podium or shrine, about 3/4 of a meter high. You got up to it via a ramp. And in the back wall of this podium area, there was a niche, the Aditan. That's likely where the main cult statue, the image of the god or goddess, would have stood.
Any specific decorations back there?
Reliefs of mountain gods adorned that podium area. There was also some evidence suggesting maybe a wooden screen separated the podium from the main cella space.
You mentioned orthostats, too. Where were they?
Right. There was this row of decorated upright stone slabs, orthostats, found sort of mid-cella. What they were for, that was debated. Maybe dividing the space somehow. Different ideas floated around.
And wasn't there another major part added later?
Yes, the ambulatory. That was part of phase 3. This was like a multi-story gallery with side chambers that wrapped around 3 sides of the main temple building, the back and the 2 long sides.
How did you get into it?
There were entrances off the main portico guarded by more lion figures.
And inside the ambulatory?
It was incredibly rich. Over 80 carved basalt panels found, plus about 30 opposing stelae, these upright slabs. They depicted all sorts of scenes. Kings, gods, people making offerings suggest it was used for something ceremonial, processions maybe, or displaying gifts to the deity.
Let's talk materials. You mentioned basalt and limestone.
Yeah, a very deliberate contrast. Dark basalt used for like the structural parts, the foundations, the reliefs, the big sculptures, mm-hmm. Very imposing. Mm-hmm. Then the lighter limestone for pavements. The thresholds where the footprints are, features in the courtyard. Sandstone pops up in the courtyard approach, too.
What about the upper parts? Walls, roof?
Probably mud brick for the upper walls, maybe timber framing and a timber roof. Those materials usually don't survive, of course.
So architecturally, it fits a known pattern.
Broadly, yes. It's a tripartite, long room plan, portico, antecella, cella. That's pretty common in Syria and the Levant. But Ain Dara has these really unique features layered on top, especially the footprints and that massive ambulatory.
And the constant rebuilding, modifications.
Shows it was a major religious center, right? People invested a lot in it over centuries.
Yeah.
Practices likely evolved too.
Okay, let's shift to the art. The sculptures and reliefs. What style are we talking about?
It's famously Syro-Hittite, sometimes called Neo-Hittite. It's this really interesting blend that emerged after the Hittite Empire collapsed around 1200 BCE.
A blend of what?
Hittite traditions, definitely, but mixed with local Syrian and Aramean artistic styles, you get these robust, kind of chunky forms, but with lots of detailed iconography, a very distinct regional look.
So what kind of sculptures are we seeing on the outside?
Okay, on the platform facade facing the courtyard, there were processions of lions and sphinxes carved in relief. Flanking the big staircase, you had those guardian sphinxes and lions, probably freestanding or nearly so. In the portico area, reliefs described as protomes, like sculpted heads sticking out and possibly cherubim figures. And then the outside walls of the ambulatory, added later, had more lions and sphinxes. Lots of protective, powerful imagery.
And inside?
More sphinxes and lions in the portico reliefs. In the antechamber, a mix of motifs. Guilloches, mountain gods, some strange clawed creatures. Lions guarding the entrance to the main cella. Inside the cella, more basalt reliefs lining the lower walls. Back on the podium, those mountain gods, maybe other mythical beings with them. And of course, all those diverse scenes on the panels and steel inside the ambulatory gallery.
Any standout individual pieces, besides the first lion found?
Well, that initial colossal basalt lion is iconic, for sure. But there were other guardian lions, lots of sphinx figures. There was also a very famous steel, often called the Ishtar Shaushka steel. Important piece, though it was found out of its original context, which complicates things. And the reliefs of the mountain gods near the podium were also very significant.
What was the function of all this sculpture? Just decoration?
Oh, much more than that. Symbolic, yeah. Definitely. Protective lions and sphinxes guarding thresholds. And potentially representational, actually depicting the gods or associated myths.
Okay, we've mentioned them a few times. Let's talk about the footprints. They sound unique.
They really were considered unique, especially back then. These aren't just little marks. They're colossal. About a meter long each.
A meter, wow. Carved into
limestone thresholds. So you have a pair of footprints, left and right, carved into the threshold entering the portico, or maybe the antecella, slight variations in reports. Then as you go deeper in, there's another threshold with just a single left footprint. And finally, at the entrance to the main cella, the holiest space, a threshold with a single right footprint.
So it's like someone enormous is walking into the temple.
Exactly. The implied stride, if you measure the distance, suggests it being maybe 20 meters tall. It's staggering.
What did scholars before 2010 think they meant?
The dominant idea was that they represented the divine presence. They marked the god's symbolic entry and movement into the inner sanctum, step by step.
Like the god is physically, or at least symbolically, inhabiting the space?
Precisely. It really connected with ancient Near Eastern ideas about the immanence of deities in their temples. Some even drew parallels to the descriptions in the book of Ezekiel about God's presence filling the temple in Jerusalem.
So this wasn't just a quirky feature. It changed how people thought about these temples.
Absolutely. It made Ain Dara invaluable for understanding how ancient people conceptualized their gods being present, and maybe how rituals involving entering the temple were performed.
Were there any comparisons found elsewhere, even if not identical footprints?
Well, nothing on that scale, or so human-like. But, you know, some other temples in the Levant from around that time did have markings on thresholds, maybe animal paws carved or other symbols. It suggests a wider concern with marking sacred thresholds, showing divine or protective presence at entrances. But the Ain Dara ones, their size and form, really stood out as unique.
Okay, so we have this amazing temple, incredible art, unique footprints. But who was it built for? Was that settled before 2010?
Definitely not settled. That was a major point of debate, largely because there were no direct inscriptions found saying, you know, Temple of God X.
So guesswork based on the evidence.
Educated interpretation, let's say. Ali Abu Asaf, the main excavator, he argued for the goddess Ishtar, or her Hurrian equivalent, Shaushka.
What was his reasoning?
He pointed to that Ishtar steel, even though it was found secondarily. Also, the sheer number of lion motifs, lions, are strongly associated with Ishtar. He also saw possible links between mountain gods, depicted in the temple, and Ishtar in some myths. And some later Astarte figurines were found nearby, though from a much later period.
Okay, so that's one theory. What was the main alternative?
The other strong contender was Baal Hadad, the storm god, or a similar regional storm deity.
Why him?
Primarily because of the footprints. That massive stride seemed, to some, much more fitting for a powerful male deity like the storm god, who was hugely important across the region. Plus, temples dedicated to storm gods were common in the area. It fit the regional context.
Any other suggestions?
Less prominent ones, maybe Astarte or perhaps a local mountain god whose name we don't know. The whole debate really highlights the difficulty, doesn't it? Interpreting religion without clear texts.
It's fascinating that such a huge, elaborate place didn't have clear signs saying this is Ishtar's house or Baal is here.
Yeah.
What does that lack of inscription tell us?
That's a great question. Maybe the identity was just understood, common knowledge within that culture. Or perhaps it was intentionally ambiguous, or maybe served more than one deity over time. It suggests religious identity could be complex.
So even before the damage in recent years, Ain Dara was obviously a big deal.
Hugely important, yes. Regionally, it was one of the best-preserved examples of Syro-Hittite religious architecture, a key site for understanding Iron Age North Syria. It was also a point of local pride, a symbol of heritage, and a tourist destination.
And then there's the Solomon's Temple connection you mentioned earlier. That seems to have been a major focus.
A huge focus. The parallels were striking and widely discussed before 2010.
What were the main similarities people pointed out?
Okay, the overall plan. Both are tripartite. Three main rooms. Both sit on a raised platform. Both have columns at the entrance, the famous Jachin and Boaz in the Bible. Both have side chambers around the main building, like Ain Dara's ambulatory, and decorative motifs. Lions, maybe cherubim, maybe palm trees, the use of orthostats, those stone slabs, and even a basin in the courtyard, the Bronze Sea, in Solomon's Temple.
So looking at Ain Dara gave scholars a real-world example of what Solomon's Temple might have looked like, since we don't have archaeological remains of that one.
Exactly. It provided crucial archaeological context. It suggested the biblical descriptions weren't just fantasy, but belonged to a known type of Levantine temple architecture from that period.
Were there significant differences, too?
Oh, sure. Ain Dara has that distinct antesala, the transverse room, which isn't described for Solomon's Temple. The exact dimensions are different, too. Ain Dara is generally wider. And, of course, no mention of giant footprints in the biblical account.
So was the idea that Solomon's Temple was directly copied from Ain Dara?
Most scholars urged caution there. It wasn't necessarily direct influence, but more likely that both temples drew on a shared architectural tradition common across the region in the Iron Age. A common blueprint, if you like.
So Ain Dara wasn't just compared to Solomon's Temple, it fit into a broader pattern.
Definitely. It's a prime example of the long room temple type found at other sites in Syria and the Levant during the late Bronze and Iron Ages. Sites like Tiltaina, maybe Ebla earlier. It shows Ain Dara participating in this widespread tradition. Oh, Hannah, the chai lady, is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Oh, wow, Hannah, this smells incredible today. Is that cardamom I'm getting? It smells so fragrant.
Definitely cardamom. And maybe a hint of ginger. It looks perfect, not too weak, not too strong. Let's see.
Oh, that's lovely. Not bitter at all today. Sometimes it needs a bit of sugar, but this is just right.
Agreed. Perfectly balanced. Hannah, you've outdone yourself. A truly excellent chai today.
Okay, let's take a quick moment for this wonderful chai.
Good idea.
All right, so where were we? We were just talking about Ain Dara fitting into that broader architectural context.
Right, and the Solomon's Temple parallels. We could even sort of list them side by side for clarity.
Good idea.
Okay, so both have that tripartite plan. Both located on a high place, both use a raised platform, dimensions are comparable, though Ain Dara is generally wider. Both have an entrance portico with columns. Ain Dara has the antesala, which seems unique in this comparison. Both have those multi-storied side chambers wrapping around.
Decorations.
Similar key elements, yeah. Lions, maybe cherubim figures, orthostats lining walls, both have a courtyard basin.
Yeah, the big difference.
No giant footprints described for Solomon's Temple, though you do get that metaphorical mention in Ezekiel about the soles of my feet in the temple.
So before 2010, Ain Dara was really seen as this vital piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. A crucial archaeological anchor point for understanding Iron Age temples in the Levant, especially with Solomon's Temple being known only from texts. Its preservation allowed scholars to see what those descriptions might have looked like in reality on the ground. It helped visualize that whole architectural world.
Okay, so wrapping up our look at Ain Dara based on pre-2010 knowledge, what are the main takeaways?
Well, several things really stand out, don't they? First, just the monumental scale of it. Second, the sophisticated architecture, that Syro-Hittite style evolving over those three phases. Third, the incredible basalt sculptures and reliefs, that powerful artwork. And fourth, undeniably, those unique, enigmatic, colossal footprints.
And the dedication. Still up in the air back then.
Still debated, yeah. Ishtar or Baal Hadad were the main candidates. But whatever the specific name, it was clearly a place of immense religious power and significance.
And its importance went beyond just Syria.
For sure. It gave us huge insights into the art, architecture, and culture of Iron Age North Syria. And as we've discussed, it provided that tangible parallel to the biblical Solomon's Temple. That comparison really enriched the understanding of religious practices and building traditions across the ancient Levant.
The detailed design, the powerful art, those footprints, it really paints a picture.
It does. It makes Ain Dara a key site for anyone studying the ancient Near East. You get this vivid image of a major religious hub, and it leaves you with fascinating questions, right? About the beliefs, the rituals of the people who built it and worshipped there.
So hopefully this exploration, sticking to what was known before 2010, gives you, our listeners, a clearer sense of why Ain Dara was, and still is, such a compelling place.
It really pushes us to think about the legacies of these ancient cultures and how archaeologists piece together their stories from the fragments left behind.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with. What is a temple like this, with its unique blend of common and extraordinary features, its devoted dedication? Tell us about just how diverse religious expression might have been back then. Something to mull over. Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.